Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Stuttered Kennedy. Chapter 8. The Return to Sandbutton. In the Wilmington Chronicle for August 21, 1844, appeared the following letter. Quote, "Sir, through the columns of your paper, will you permit me, in behalf of the relatives and friends of the late Major George W. Glover of Wilmington, and his bereaved lady, to return our thanks and express the feeling of gratitude we owe and cherish towards those friends of the deceased who so kindly attended him during his last sickness, and who still extend their care and sympathy to the lone, feeble, and bereaved widow after his decease. Much has often been said of the high feeling of honor and noble generosity of heart which characterizes the people of the South. Yet when we listen to Mrs. Glover, my sister, whilst recounting the kind attentions paid to the deceased during his last illness, the sympathy extended to her after his death, and the assistance volunteered to restore her to her friends at a distance of more than 1,000 miles, the power of language would be but beggared by any attempt at expressing the feelings of the swelling bosom. The silent gush of grateful tears alone can tell the emotions of the thankful heart. Words are indeed but a meager tribute for so noble an effort in behalf of the unfortunate. Yet it is all we can award. Will our friends at Wilmington accept it, the tribute of grateful hearts? Many thanks are due to Mr. Cook, who engaged to accompany her only to New York, but did not desert her or remit his kind attentions until he saw her in the fond embrace of her friends. Your friend and obedient servant, George S. Baker, Sandbutton Bridge, New Hampshire, August 12, 1844. End quote. So the story is told in the grandiose language of the day. It is supplemented by a diary kept by Mary herself of her journey and still preserved. A simple, weary record to modern thought of almost incredible laboriousness. The 1,000 miles must have seemed interminable. By rail from Wilmington to Portsmouth, Virginia, with a change of cars at Weldon, North Carolina. Thence by boat to Baltimore, and on by another boat to Frenchton. From Frenchton, the two traveled across the state of Delaware by rail to Newcastle, whence they took a boat to Philadelphia. They took another boat to Bristol, Pennsylvania, and then on by rail to Jersey City, and by ferry to New York. And so on by stage and train to Concord, New Hampshire, and Sandbutton. We must imagine the actual homecoming of the meeting of Abigail with her widowed daughter, of the one by one hesitant approach of old friends, of the messages which must have come from far and near, of the letters from Augusta, and many others, and the visits of the old minister, with all the time Mark in the background, a monumental struggle between Calvinism and the Sermon on the Mount. It is not difficult to picture it all, interwoven as it must have been with the ever-present pathetic looking forward to the event that was now so near. It was on September 11, 1844, that the child, a son, was born. He was called George after his father, and immediately sent away to the care of a woman nearby, a Mrs. Amos Morrison, wife of a mechanic who had recently had a child of her own. For Mary was very low. The death of her husband, the long and weary journey home, followed by a difficult confinement, had left her so utterly exhausted that for weeks her life was despaired of. Characteristically enough, the whole situation seems to have reacted on Mark more hardly than on anyone else. The same sudden revulsion of feeling which had caused him years before to rouse himself from the foreboding part in which he always cast himself and drive frantically down the hill from Bow to fetch the doctor, crying to a neighbor, "Mary is dying," now caused him to do everything in his power to protect his sick daughter from the slightest disturbing noise. He strewed tan bark on the road outside her window, so the story goes, and seemed possessed by a desire to make some kind of reparation, however clumsy, for past hardness. Very slowly, Mary got better. But weeks had passed into months before a really decided improvement could be observed. And even then, it became evident that more than one chronic disability would have to be contended with. The spinal weakness, which she had had from early girlhood, and to which her mother alludes in one of her letters, was very much accentuated, and at times she suffered great pain. Abigail and the faithful Mahala were devoted in their care, and in the end, Mary struggled back to life. It was months before she could see her little son, and the months had almost run into years before she had him around with her as much as a normal mother would want. Thus, from the very first, was established that severance in association, so much stronger in effect upon the child than the mother, which in years to come was to result in their complete separation. Mahala Sanborn was the one that looked after the little boy. It was to her he had recourse in his first troubles, and with her he shared his first exuberant excesses. For little George took after his father. From the first, he was a sturdy, restless youngster, and even before he learned anything else, he learned, with the inevitable intuition of the young animal, that it was Mahala who did not care how much noise he made, while with his mother, his excesses had to be abated, if not by her, by somebody else. Very slowly, Mary began to pick up the threads of her new old life. It was rather a sad business at first. She was more beautiful than ever, and always possessed of a strangely compelling charm. It was not long before first this one and then that one among the young men in her circle were, with no little diffidence, offering their humble respects again. But her brief excursion into happiness, with its tragic ending, remained a poignant memory. And although outwardly entering more and more into the life of those around her, nothing was the same as it had been before. One little poem still preserved, written about this time, reveals her attitude of mind with a curiously pathetic beauty, which crept into her verse-making only when she was really deeply moved. It is entitled Wind of the South, and its last two verses are nearer real poetry than anything Mary had written up to this time. Yes, balmy breeze, when evening glows, oh, pitying, come and kiss my cheek, but no, thy sighing would disclose thee hither from the grave I seek. O say, do worms dare revel round the casket where no gems can rust? Hath loveliness a level found beneath the cold and common dust? But once again, youth and time, combined with an indomitably optimistic religious sense, won the victory. She took up writing again, and this time she made use of every medium: fiction, poetry, essay writing. According to the reminiscences of Sarah Clement Kimball, village tongues were set wagging by the eager attentions paid the young widow, hard upon her return to Sandbutton, by a young clergyman, the Reverend Richard S. Rust, who became principal of a Methodist academy called the New Hampshire Conference Seminary, which was opened in Sandbutton early in 1845. The two had much in common, and it was not long before he had offered Mary a position as substitute teacher in the academy. Mr. Rust was also editor of a fraternal magazine called The Covenant, and he welcomed Mary's writings to its columns. She made good use of her opportunity, as the files of the magazine clearly show. And if the quality of her output obviously suffers from a lack of that discipline involved in an acceptance on merit only and not on favor, it shows that she was making a serious effort to support herself with the only means she had. Emma Clinton, A Tale of the Frontier, a novelette in 4 chapters. The Test of Love, a short story. Aaron, the Smile and the Tear in Thine Eyes, an essay advocating Irish freedom, and quite a number of short poems: The Emigrant's Farewell, The Moon, The Old Man of the Mountain, and so on. There is nothing distinguished about it all. Most of it is hack writing in the remorselessly pedantic style of the day. It is interesting, however, as a revelation of the fact to become so evident later on, that Mary writing for effect and Mary writing on something about which she really cared were almost unrecognizably different. Quote, can a feeling pervade the benevolent bosom in any one of Eve's fair daughters, opposed to the best interests of her sex, the extension of benevolent institutions, simply because they are of secret origin? Even with such, if indeed there are any, we trust the avenues to reason and sentiment, though chilled, are not quite frozen in the icy fetters of speculative views, or the colder icebergs of popular surmise closing them effectually from the genial sunshine of truth, reason's twin sister. Rather would we spare this immortal boon, heaven's best gift to mortals, so sad a libel on its power or research, as to suppose any subject not first fully understood would be condemned. But if reason is not suffered to act, slumbering on any unwary sentinel at her post, truth is her foe, ignorance her friend, yea, unwarrantable ignorance, whose legitimate offspring are prejudice and blind error. And what enlightened female of this century would not blush to acknowledge herself the dupe of some misguidings? End quote. Thus, an extract from an essay on Odd Fellowship in the Covenant. The sentiment is good enough, even characteristically sound. but compared with the simple power of her later prose, the style is incredibly bad. It is only so by comparison, however. It was largely the newspaper, and to a very considerable extent, the literary style of the day. And however indifferent, it laid the foundation, in Mary's case, for something of real excellence. Anyway, it more than passed muster with the Reverend Richard Rust. For the young widow began to have no lack of admirers, and the Reverend Richard was a frequent visitor in the Baker household. So frequent that those whose business it was to do so were already beginning to speculate as to the significance and probable outcome of it all. It quickly became apparent, however, that Richard was not the only one. There were John M. Burt and Luther Bean and James Smith and a boy who finds a record only under his nickname, Sleeper, and several others, all of whom were duly speculated upon in their turn. As to Mary, although she entered into it all, as would any other young girl, she was no more. She got very tired of it at times. In a letter to her friend Martha Rand, who was later to marry her brother Sullivan, she indulges herself in a mild outburst of annoyance over the gossip about herself and John Burt. "John M. Burt," she writes, "has paid an annual visit to the homestead, not I, recently, and spoke of Miss Rand very kindly, wished me to send a little love to her. He now intends to go to Wisconsin after he graduates in August. I hope, then, people will mind their business about us, as I am getting a little mad at their lies, for such they are." This letter to Mathy, as Mary calls her friend, gives an interesting picture of Mary about this time, the spring of 1847. In many ways, it is reminiscent of the letter she wrote from Beau to her brother Sullivan, "the second letter I ever wrote, so many years before." It is again a sleepy afternoon, and again with the family away, this time all at church, and again the solitude and the silence are well calculated to influence memory to bring up the light of other days. It is the same kind of cloud and sunshine letter. At one moment, so weary of solitude, I have half determined this very moment to throw aside my pen and wait and weep. And the next, rallying herself to a more cheerful outlook and entertaining her friend with some excellent gossip about their mutual friends and their doings in Sandbutton. The Sem ladies are getting up a fair, not fair, to defray the expenses of building operations, such as fitting up an assembly room. Miss Lane is the directress. Professor Sanborn is leaving the town with his wife and children, and so on. And then she comes back to Mathy and how she wishes they could be together somehow during the coming summer. "Get a school together, or in some way manage it." She begs Mathy to be careful of her health, the greatest earthly blessing, without which little else can be enjoyed, and bids her not to be anxious about the future, but to rely on God. Please excuse this hasty scrawl. George has been constantly at my elbow, which must account for the execution. Let me hear from you very soon, and all I could wish. And now adieu. Believe me, truly thine, Mary M. Glover. The picture seems to be complete enough. Mary making the best of it. Her little boy constantly at her elbow. She is interested, tremendously so at times, in all that goes on around her. But there is evident, through it all, a deep-seated discontent which every now and again sinks out of sight and sound, but is never completely eliminated. Is it not so, she writes to Matthew? Does not the heart find utterance in disappointment? Of all the suitors who thronged Mary about this time, there was just one who seems to have won some place in her affections, John M. Bartlett, a young lawyer who, after a brilliant record in the Harvard Law School, went out to Sacramento, California to engage in law practice, and died there within a few short weeks of his arrival. He had known Mary for some years, and before leaving for California, spent the summer in San Bunton. Mary, by that time, had no doubt achieved a certain measure of freedom, so that her future was not, as it was at first, so much a matter of speculation. At any rate, although the two were together quite often, it seems to have attracted very little attention, and probably nothing would have been known of the understanding which existed between them if it had not been for a pathetically prim notation in Mrs. Eddy's handwriting under Bartlett's obituary notice, which she had cut out and put in her scrapbook. It runs, "He was engaged to marry Mrs. Glover when he left New Hampshire." Many years afterwards, Mrs. Eddy was to write in her book, Retrospection and Introspection, "Early had I learned that whatever is loved materially as mere corporeal personality is eventually lost." It is not difficult to believe that she had reference to these days, for the loss of her husband was only the beginning of a long series of bereavements and separations, which in the course of a few years were to leave her alone. When she said goodbye to young Bartlett as he set out for the then almost mythical California, she was already within the shadow of another loss, perhaps the most bitter of her life, her mother. Abigail Baker had fought a good fight. She had worked hard all her life, not only in the great task of peacemaker and moderator in a household which, but for her, would often have been hard-pressed by the grimness of her husband's religious views. She had been ailing for some time, and eager at first from a sense of duty to recover. Her youngest son, George Sullivan, was soon to marry Martha Rand, and she held up until then. But after she had seen them married and waved their last farewells as they set out for their new home in Baltimore, she realized that she was very worn and tired. "Let me go to my home of eternal rest," she said. That was on November 4, 1849. She died on the 21st. Mary was desolate, and there was no one to whom she could turn. As so often happens in such cases, she never seems to have thought of her father apart from her mother. And now that her mother was gone, her father was almost a stranger to her. Mark, in the aura of her mother's plea to think kindly of her father, and of her assurance that he loved her as much as any of his children, was one thing. But Mark, deprived of this benediction, was quite another. It was much the same with Mark. He never seems to have thought of Mary apart from Abigail. Only thus can be explained the change which seems to have come over them both after Abigail dies. But that was to come afterwards. Meanwhile, Mary writes to George in Baltimore. "Oh, George, what is left of earth to me? But, oh, my mother! She has suffered long with me. Let me be willing she should now rejoice, and I bear on till I follow her. I cannot write more. My grief overpowers me." Her mother had been buried only a few weeks when news came to her that John Bartlett had died in Sacramento. All her life, Mary was at her best in a crisis. And at this crisis, when her long struggle against ill health would seem inevitably to presage complete collapse under the added burden, a traditional sense of duty, so common in New England in those days, came to her rescue. She was the only one left at home, and she was needed. Mark Baker had prospered. Some shrewd railroad investments had proved very profitable. In the year before Abigail's death, he had built a handsome house in the colonial style just off the main street of Sandbutton and next door to the house of his eldest daughter, Abigail Tilton, and moved his family there. He could well have afforded to employ a housekeeper, but Mary was now the natural head of the house from the woman's standpoint, and she bravely rose to the occasion. She kept house for him loyally through the winter, bore as best she could with his uncertain temper and his growing dislike of her little boy, and sought to make a home out of the wreckage left by Abigail's passing. The task was one of increasing difficulty, and it ended abruptly in what, for Mary, was another tragedy. Mark Baker was 64. All his life, he had been used to having a woman around his home, who, as far as he could see, had no doubt as to her place or his, who cared for her part of the great enterprise efficiently and well, and left him undisturbed in the satisfying assurance that he was the head of the household and the final arbiter in all matters of importance, religious or profane. First, it was his mother, the wise, placid Anne Moore McNeil. Then it was Abigail. Left alone with Mary, in whom he had found all too often his own dogged obstinacy confronting him in the form of quiet convictions which made him feel defeat before he had begun to argue, it is no wonder that he sought a quick way out of his difficulty. He decided to marry again, and his choice fell upon Mrs. Elizabeth Patterson Duncan, a widow of Candia, New Hampshire. She was a woman of good family, sister of George W. Patterson, sometime Lieutenant Governor of New York, an ample, placid-looking woman, judging from her picture, who probably fitted exactly into the place in his home that Mark Baker had designed for her. The prospect filled Mary with dismay, for it quickly became evident that it would not only mean that she would have to leave home, but that she would be separated from her boy. Her sister, Abigail, next door, offered her a home. But she had a son of her own, a delicate, ailing child of four. And Mary's six-year-old George, who always had given promise of outdoing his father in energy, would not be welcome. It was one of those unhappy circumstances which was probably nobody's fault. Abigail had always been kind to Mary, but she was becoming a wealthy woman. She had grown used to comfort, and the prospect of having George about the house all day and every day did not appeal to her from any angle. Moreover, there was, as she saw it, an easy way of solving the problem. George had always regarded Mahala Sanborn, the old baker's servant, as his staple recourse. Mahala was devoted to him, and he to Mahala. What more natural than that George should be sent to live with Mahala, who now, happily married to one Russell Cheney, had settled in the little village of North Groton, some 40 miles away. And so it was arranged. Mary, delicate and without resources, the final winding up of her husband's affairs had left her practically nothing, could not have much voice in the matter. George was sent away, and Mary moved into Abigail's home. "The night before my child was taken from me," she wrote years afterwards in Retrospection and Introspection, "I knelt by his side throughout the dark hours, hoping for a vision of relief from this trial." Outwardly, when he had gone, she made the best of it. But thenceforward, her every thought was motivated by one desire: to find the vision, to bring about a reunion between herself and her son, she always maintained. The first need, as she rightly saw it, was to make herself self-supporting. She had tried writing with a certain measure of success, but it was too uncertain when it came to the question of actually supporting herself and her child. So she conferred with her old friend Richard Rust, and he, a long way ahead of his time, having had experience of Mary's ability as a teacher in his own academy, urged her to open an infant school in the little town. It was a novelty, of course, but Mary took up the idea with enthusiasm. She secured a small building behind her sister's home, which had formerly been used as a shoemaker's shop, and there she opened her school. She had painted it red, as a schoolhouse should be, and fitted it out with little desks and chairs, all complete. There is not much evidence as to how she fared or how long the novel experiment carried on. Only one of her pupils in later life left any recollections of the little school and its teacher. That was one Sarah Clement, daughter of Zenas Clement, a friend and neighbor of Mark Baker at Sandbutton. And she only remembered isolated incidents such as would fasten themselves on the memory of a small child of 6 or 7. One incident, however, which she recalled very vividly, is worth recording. It appears that Sarah was not being at all well behaved in class. Indeed, she was behaving very badly. And so, after repeated admonitions, Mrs. Glover sent her out into the garden to get a switch, with which she was to be whipped. When Sarah returned with the smallest twig she could find, Mrs. Glover, regardless of all the claims of dignity or discipline, burst out laughing, openly forgave her, and sent her back to her seat unpunished. Sarah seems to have been devoted to her teacher. She loved her, she says, for her kindness and cheerfulness. and the picture she has left of how, on summer evenings, she would run across the road, climb up on the gate of the Tilton home, and watch Mrs. Glover as she worked in the garden. The two talking comfortably back and forth is welcome enough, if only for the measure of peace it suggests. But Mary was just making the best of it. In her heart all the time was the thought of the little boy in Groton. And then there was Abigail, meaning to be kind, but more masterful than ever. No vision of relief had so far been seen.